Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tron. Han, how are you this evening?
I am doing swell, Jim. Thanks for asking. How about yourself?
Doing good, doing good. Episode number 48. We are screaming towards episode 50. Amazing. Never really thought we'd get that far, did we?
Well, we, you know, we can see how far we go, and I'm glad. You know, 48. That means it's almost a year. We have almost did a complete year of broadcasting. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that is cool, and reality is we really haven't even touched the complete surface of the possibility of topics and things. And tonight's topic is an interesting one because it's kind of like a, I don't know, I want to call it a combination of a lot of little things that we've talked about over the numerous other podcasts. And as always, if you'd like, please, you know, jump onto our website. And you can get to those podcasts and listen to those at your leisure. But tonight's show is Code, Design, and Common Sense. And that's kind of a quirky title. But in the sense that really what we're going to discuss are the many issues that are related to developing a dental facility in regards to the code and how it affects design. And basically just common sense of what you should look at, what you should think about. You know, it's all Bill uses this phrase a lot of times. You don't know what you don't know. And if you don't know the question to ask, then how do you get the question asked? And so we're going to discuss a lot of those things to help at least give you the parameters and maybe give you some of those questions that you might ask. If you're not going to use someone like us, if you're going to use some other design professional or whomever, at least you have some basis to start from. Because the worst thing we want to have happen is you start a process, you start down the road, and all of a sudden something comes up and proverbially bites you. You don't know what you don't know, as Bill would say, and you turn around and as you're well into the process, it becomes known that, oh crap, we should have asked that question back in the beginning, or we should have addressed that issue. We should look at it. So knowing the questions to ask is half the battle when designing a very efficient, extremely functional and aesthetically pleasing office. But at the same time, utilizing issues, as Han and I call it, common sense. So, Han, I'll let you kind of discuss a little bit about the general crux of what we were thinking.
Let me good evening, everyone. Let me summarize what Jim just said. And the mantra on our program, the name of the program is Straight Talk. Okay, so we're not here to sugarcoat anything. You have a question, we'll see what we can do to answer your question. And the mantra on our program is the only question or the only dumb question is the one you don't ask. So even if it sounds weird or you're not comfortable with asking the question, shoot anyway, okay? You are in the process of developing, designing, and building your office, whether it's in a lease space or a brand new building, you're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, up to several million dollars. Okay, that is what, that will qualify it as big ticket items. So before you buy those big ticket items. You research and you ask a ton of questions until you're comfortable. Otherwise, you're going to spend a ton of money getting less than what you're looking for. Okay, so basically that I encourage you to. You don't even have to tell us your real name. You don't have to tell us where you, you know, what state you're from. Just simply, you know, ask the question. If you don't want us to recognize your voice, go on to our website, type in the question, and we'll get your answer. All right? So anyway, code. I don't want to beat it to death. We had talked about it in numerous of other episodes, but code is something that we all, you know, it's a regulatory requirement. Okay? We can't go around it. We can't ignore it. Just like you running your practice, there's certain legal requirement that you have to meet. If you don't, you can find yourself in big trouble. And we do the same. There is certain things that we have to do because it's required of us. All right? The three things, we spoke about the three primary things that we that's at the forefront of everything we do. It has to do with life, health, and safety. Those are the three things that we live by, that we work to meet and enhance and all that. The main thing is in your building, you can replace the building if something happens. If it floods, if it gets taken away by hurricane or tornado or burnt down, those are assets. Those are physical things you can replace, but you can't replace life. So what we do mainly is to make sure that the building that we design are safe. And there's regulations that have been put in place because of historical events and stuff like that, that unfortunately are taking human life. So code become the standard of all buildings. Every building that I design, whether it's a home, a gas station, a shopping mall, or a dentist office, they all have a minimum requirement that the code dictate that you have to go by. So everything we do are code-related. Code often establishes the minimum threshold that we have to meet. And so often, we have discussions among our dentists and other clients and stuff like that, where they say, why do I have to do that? And my friends don't. And I don't want to be smart aleck. Is that your friend's building, what they have or don't have, has no bearing on what is required of your building. Okay? So we can only design around what is currently in force. In your specific municipality, based on the parameter that you have, that we have to work around. Okay, so what other have done, with their building, to their building, before, after construction, has absolute no bearing on your project. Okay, let me repeat that. What other people in their building have done for their building, to their building, has absolutely no bearing on yours. We have to design it around the code. Okay. Example, have this discussion recently. In the last 24 hours, an office was built, and they had, naturally, in your operatory, you either have one door or two doors. It either can be opening or swing doors, pocket door, barn door, whatever door you want to do. It depends on your specialty. Noise isolation could be something that's really important if you're a pediatric dentist and you have a young patient in your chair that love to scream or want to scream. So you might want to isolate the noise. So anyway, it's talking about doors because in some municipality, they, you know, the code official are pretty nonchalant about having the typical ADA requirement for clearance on the latch side of the door. And some will are pretty stickler about it. In this case, it was in the state of Texas, and they were pretty stickler about it. And in this situation, they say that you have to have 18 inches of clear distance on the strike side of the door. In this particular office, apparently, between the two doors, there's only 36 inches of wall. And a TV was put on there, and that TV violated or infringed into that clear space, that clear 18-inch space. So, you know, what do you do in that case? Secondly, because it was a tow entry operatory, so therefore the toward the door on both sides, it's a path of you know of travel. So the TV itself sticks out more than the allowable 4 inches from the face of the wall. So there's two citations. Okay, those are code things because it's a you know besides the building code, you also have ADA standard and guidelines that you have to meet. So the ADA is federal, the building code is state. You know, federal, you deal with the Department of Justice. All right, you fix it or they'll fix it for you, and they might even shut you down. So code, when you work with, when you do a design, please don't, if somebody tells you that they can design it for you and then you take it to your architect and the architect will fix it, my sentiment is, then why the hell did you let them work on your drawing without fixing it to start out with? You don't kick the can down the road because that kick in the can down the road could cost you dearly because it's after the fact. You could sign the lease because of a design that you love and it didn't work, or you wish it, you buy a building based on a design that didn't work. Okay, trust me, it did happen. We fixed it, right? So code, stick to it. Make sure that whoever work on your project include that element of the design to make sure everything's compliant, not just simply did the design, pass it on to the next guy. All right, Jim?
So Han, you're saying design during the code during the actual design process, like we advocate, that we look at and evaluate and deal with the code issues during even the preliminary design process, that very first blush at what the floor plan or the actual layout of that particular building would look like. I want to give a little example, and this might be a little technical, but I think it's important to at least let our listeners realize what this is involved. We go through this. We've been trained to work with this as architects, years of education and practical experience. But a typical code book, and I've got one here in front of me. We don't have any video for tonight's show, of course. But, you know, it's well over 800 pages. And it's just a simple Ohio building code. And this is just one of several codes that actually impact a particular building. And some of the things that we're going to, that we would first identify and start off this process with would be the use group. Now, what the heck is a use group? Well, a use group is what the building's actually used for. And typically, dental offices fall under the B category for business because it specifically says in there that professional services like architects, attorneys, dentists, engineers, and so on fall under the B group. Now, you take the B group, or in this case, the business group, and then you go further into the code, and there's all kinds of other requirements like your allowable building area and allowable building height. So according to the Ohio Building Code, a B group depending on the type of construction, and then this is getting complicated, I understand that, but this is what we deal with. And you have your design professional has to understand this stuff. So utilizing the most the least restrictive type of construction, it tells us that you're allowed to have a two-story building under a Type 5 and 9,000 square feet, and that's if the building is not sprinkled. If the building has a sprinkler system, you can basically double that. You can go to a three-story building and 18,000 square feet. Now, 9,000 square feet and 18,000 square feet, that's a pretty big dental office. But there are dental offices that reach that point. So your design team has to understand what you're going for and what you're looking at. Then you take it even, this goes deeper and deeper and deeper. The next step, what I'm trying to show is the example of just how involved this is. You then move over to under the types of construction, the fire resistant rating requirements. There is a chart and a graph that requires under, let's say you're using the Type 5 again, and it's unsprinkled. Structural frame has to have a 1 hour rating. Bearing walls have to have 1 hour ratings. Floors have to have 1 hour ratings. Roof has to have a 1 hour rating with a few exceptions. Now, what the heck does 1 hour rating mean? Well, there's a whole set of criteria where testing's been done and the assembly basically lasts for 1 hour under a fire load, so that there's a fire in the building, it doesn't transition to the next building, or it doesn't transition to the next room, or it doesn't transition to the next floor for an hour. And there's a whole bunch of criteria as to what that involves. And that's just one little aspect, and it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. We won't get into it tonight, but I wanted to give that example of just what that means. So like if you have a fire rated 1 hour exterior wall, it's going to restrict your openings. It's going to restrict your windows. It's going to restrict your doors. Some of those doors will have to be fire rated. Some of the doors would have to be sized accordingly with special glass. Sometimes windows will have to be treated specially. I mean, it's just a very involved technical aspect. So the intricacy is deep, and it needs to be correctly done from the beginning, as opposed to, well, let's just, like Honda is saying, you know, come up with the bubble diagram / overall look of the place, and then give it off to your contractor, who actually is not the one that's trained to use the code. They would have to integrate some kind of architectural firm or entity to then create the necessary documents that can actually satisfy the particular code requirements. So it's Han, I guess you put it the best way. It's kind of like putting the cart before the horse. You're not even hooking the cart and the horse together.
It could be a rude discovery that what you have been paid, as a design, or you know, if you convince yourself that the best people to design your office is the guy who sell you the equipment, okay. But once you discover that it didn't work, you're in a pickle, okay. Now here's the reason why it is important about those fire-rated walls and stuff like that. What happened is, let's say next door has a fire. The next door suite has a fire, and the wall between you is 1 hour rated. It just simply means it gives you enough time to grab your purse, your wallet, your keys, and get out. Okay? That basically that. It gives you enough time to gather a few important stuff and get out of the building to save your life. So those are the minimum requirements. You can have less, but you can make that wall more stringent. Okay? Again, code sets the minimum requirement. So it is, you know, again, you know, life, health, and safety. That's what it's about. That's what the code, primary purpose of the code. Right?
And so someone might ask the question, why don't you just design it as not restrictive, but as the highest possible restrictive rating and those kind of things? Well, because the cost. The cost, as you become more restrictive and have to have higher rating exposure between floors or walls or tenant separations, it adds cost. And these costs are not small costs. They're pretty substantial costs. So we have to balance the code requirement against the cost requirement and create it in such a way that it's actually the most efficient and use of your money. Because this doesn't matter if you're doing a new design on a vacant piece of property, if you're doing a retail space where you're going in and just dealing with your particular suite, if you're talking about an existing building that you're renovating, the code's the code. All of those issues relate to that particular code. And a little quirk most people don't understand, and I think we may have touched on it before, Han, is if you have an existing building and that building was built, let's say it was built in 1974. I don't know why I picked that year, but let's just say it was 1974. The code was totally different back in 1974. So you can't walk into that building, change the name on the front door, and start using it. Because it's not up to code. It's not up to the current code. And the minute you go in and change anything, you have to bring it up to code. Han, you want to talk about that a little bit? Because we've dealt with it a lot.
Yeah, we do. If you buy a building, even if it's a dentist's office, you know, and prior, and you go, I'm a dentist, that was a dentist's office, and I can go in and do my business. There's a yes and there's no. If you're going to go in and simply turn on the light and, you know, and throw a new shingle up, you probably could be running the same business with grandfather. However, if you start changing things, you know, you go like, that was 1975. This is 2019, 2020. I want it to be more modern. Things is not working out. I need to renovate it and make a few changes. That's when things get a little bit, you know, hairy, because you may, you may be required to change, upgrade your electrical system, your mechanical system, your plumbing system. And by the way, 1975, the American with Disability Act have not been created yet. Okay, so you have to bring everything up to the accessibility code as well. So it gets a little, you know, this is where you sit down with your design professionals and strategize what makes sense and what are you required to do. Okay, back up a little bit of that. When we get onto a project, we typically do at least a preliminary code analysis on the project. What would be required? And when Jim say that his, you know, the code book, the Ohio Building Code Book, is, you know, like 800 pages, that is only the building code. There is mechanical, electrical, structural, plumbing, those have their own set of codes too. Okay? So you're talking about almost a library of codes. But, you know, sit down, figure out what it is, make, you know, and lay out your plan, and then strategize how to execute it, whether you do it once or do it, break down two pieces. If you, in my opinion, okay, just strictly my opinion, if you're going to have you're going to have headache, all right, take one big lump sum and do it instead of drag it out for weeks or months. Renovation is a pain. It's disruptive. It's costly. You might as well swallow the pill and say, let's do it. Do it one time. Jim?
Yeah. Well, and code does a lot of things in the sense that it mandates minimum requirements for corridor widths. It mandates minimum requirements for doors and exits. It mandates minimum requirements for windows. It mandates minimum requirements for things like fresh air, number of toilet fixtures, number of sinks, number of laboratories, number of everything. It mandates a minimum requirement for lights. It mandates a minimum requirement. Did I say fresh air?
Yes.
I can't remember. But it mandates a minimum of everything. And it even mandates a minimum requirement in the sense that if I'm in a building, I can only be so far away from an exit door if there's a fire. So all of that is something that has to be integrated into the design from the beginning, in our mind. It's like you got to do it from the beginning as opposed to try to fix it later. And Han,
hey,
you brought up the aspect go ahead.
One thing that you didn't mention is that something that I seldom seen on design that I spend time to critique. It's called dead end corridors. Okay, it's the code mandate that you cannot have a corridor that is I think longer 20 than 25
feet.
20 to 25 feet. Okay,
20 feet.
And so that way, if you are at the end of a corridor, within 20 feet in front of you, you should be able to either make a left or right. Or there's an exit door. That if we don't have that, that's called dead end corridor. It's not allowed. Okay.
Right.
Anyway,
and
Jim, what do you want to say?
And then, you know, on top of all of that, we have to create something that's obviously aesthetically pleasing and extremely functional, and make sure that it works for what you need it to be, so you're being as efficient as you possibly can be, so that when your patients come in the door, they get to have a great experience, both from a dental service aspect, but also from experiencing the space. And remember, go back to our podcast about first impression, and go back to our podcasts about the overall process. I mean, it's all in there. But another thing we haven't talked about, and it has to do with the practical examples of the code standpoint, is storage. Now, here, that's a sticky wicket, but in reality, it's a reality. That's kind of weird, but that's exactly what it is. In the code, storage is a different use group. It's not business. It's called storage because typically what you store in a storage area are things that are more flammable than you would within a business area. So there's ancillary storage, which is a very small portion of a business, and that's mandated in the code. But I'm talking about, let's use an example. I put a basement in my dental office, and I'm going to use that basement to store all the crap that I need to keep, everything from archived files to leftover pieces of equipment that I maybe one day will restore, and or for that matter, supplies.
Christmas supplies, decorations?
You know, Christmas decorations, you name it.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? That's a different use group, falls under a different criteria, and has a different set of rules related to it. So, and then you have to integrate that into your building in such a way that you have to separate that use group from your original building. So what that means is, 9 times out of 10, is your floor in a basement scenario is going to be fire rated. So between the basement ceiling and the floor of the first floor, you have a fire rated ceiling. So all of a sudden now, when you start punching holes through that, to do things, there's a whole bunch of criteria that have to be followed, like when you put a ductwork through there or where you put a pipe through there, there's criteria that have to be followed. That criteria adds cost. So all of that has to be integrated properly into the design. The other thing you were talking about, Han, is the handicap issue. And when I say handicapped, I mean American with Disabilities Act, which came in to effect, what would you say, I think 74?
No, 75. 1991.
You're right. Okay. 1991.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it came into effect. So those old buildings that were before them were not designed for that. So that has to be designed into the new design and has to be designed into anything that we would renovate, for example. So, and that deals with everything from the ability for people to get into your building with wheelchairs, up ramps, steps, corridor widths, accessibilities, access to doors, dimensions from doors to walls. I mean, the list is endless. And, that, you know, that's all there. So, you know, again, back to those things to ask the question about that you maybe never even thought about. Well, those are some of the things that you would ask the question about. You know, is this existing building that I'm looking at even work from a handicapped ADA standpoint? And that's where we come in. We can help you determine whether that's even, if it's even practical. Juan?
There's a, there's such thing as called over design, okay, or under design. What I encourage you to do, and encourage your team, your design team to do also, is that actually reach out to the building official and confirm what would be how they interpret the code requirement, so that way the design can be done appropriately. For instance, if you, let's say, code says that you have to have 2 ADA compliant bathrooms, okay, for the public. So you have one in the front, one to the back, so for the patient that are in for treatment. And then you say, well, my staff, I like them to have a toilet room for themselves. I have my own private office, and I like to have a private office, you know, private toilet room for myself. And your designer or architect say, you know, code say that you have to have every bathroom have to be ADA compliant. And so every bathroom in your building or in your office space is ADA compliant. But the reality may be is that you already, the code say you have to have 2 accessible toilet room, accessible mean ADA compliant toilet room, based on the size of your building. So anything else that you provided may, and that's actually the discretion of the building official because you already met the code, can be non-compliant or adaptable. Adaptable means that it is compliant. The only thing you don't have is a grab bar, okay? But those things, the difference between having an ADA-compliant bathroom and a non-ADA-compliant bathroom could be a matter of 20 square feet, okay, give or take. 20 square feet could give you a lot of elbow room someplace else. So instead of simply designing, without confirming the minimum requirement, you can overspend, overdesign. So that is something that we often do, or always do, is to confirm what is it that the building official require. Because the biggest complaint we often get is, my bathroom, my private bathroom is ginormous, okay? And why is that? Well, a couple of things can happen, because the building official say that's what you must provide, or your architect never make the phone call to have that conversation. Okay, so I encourage you to encourage your team. If we're not on your team, have your team actually make that conversation, that phone call. Okay, we had a discussion just recently where a dentist is renovating his office, and he goes, I submitted the drawing for a permit, and the city came back and said, I have to put in a drinking fountain. Yeah, it's part of the code. Okay. Who dropped the ball? Why was it not in the drawing? And what would be your argument that everybody that has a commercial office have to provide the minimum requirement to meet code, and you're the exception? Okay, that's when it's kind of hard to swallow that somebody did not do the proper job, and now you got to find a place to that's already tight to squeeze in a drinking fountain. Newsflash: when it comes to drinking fountain, you're not providing one like in the old days at your school where it's only a fixture. You have two. All right, most municipal require two. One for the average folks, the other one is for the ADA requirements, set lower. So it's usually a larger unit that has two. You've seen those. You go into the hospital, you go into the mall, you go wherever there's business, you see and you go like, hey, that's a drinking fountain. It has two, one high, one low. It's because that's code. So you're not just looking for a little space to put a drinking fountain. You've got space, it takes up a good size of wall space to provide what the code requires. So those homework got to be done. Those code analysis need to be done so that way it's designed appropriately, not under design or over design. Jim?
Right. And that's a very important point that you bring out, that we do as a standard operating procedure is meet with the code officials, meet with the building officials to review the document while it's early in the design phase so that they can input into anything that needed to be adjusted or tweaked, or that they have an understanding of where you're going with it. Because the worst thing you want to do is go through the whole design process, complete everything, submit it for a building permit, and get it turned down because of those kind of issues. So that goes back to the same approach we were talking about before. Don't design the project in a void without the code components being integrated into it, and then come back later and try to fit it in. The building won't look like what you thought it was going to look like in the beginning. That, that little bubble diagram that they sent you to go work on and tweak and that kind of stuff, it won't be that. It will be something totally different, because trying to do the things like integrating a drinking fountain or integrating another bathroom or integrating in a handicapped restroom in a place where you were going to have one that was just going to be a small little, airport style, airplane style bathroom. I mean, it takes up large square footages and then that messes up everything. So it is a complicated puzzle that needs to be worked all together in unison, not in a void. Now, one of the things that, and I guess it's important for us to talk about Han because this is Straight Talk. Don't be under the delusion that you can say things like, well, okay, I'm going to call this room something else and then use it and use it for what I really want it to be down the road, because that thing that I wanted to be down the road is more restrictive, and but I didn't want to spend the money to do that. For example, I didn't want to spend the money to fire rate the walls or to sprinkle the put a fire suppression system or a sprinkler system in my storage basement or my storage room. But I'm going to use it as storage later after they give me my certificate of occupancy. Guess what? You'll get tagged, because most municipalities have an entity known as a fire marshal. And that fire marshal periodically comes through and reviews your building and how you're using that building. Here in Maumee, where we reside, they come in every 6 months. Sometimes they come in every year, they come in whatever, but they're in here every 6 months reviewing the building. And that's my simple little office building. They walk through Bill's dental offices and they pick those things up. And they will tag your building and say, this has to be rectified. You know, one of the most expensive things to do is try to fix something like that after you've already used it. It becomes costly, way more costly than just doing it right in the first place. And I know we've heard others that, Han, you've heard it before, that said, well, you know, go ahead and put that thing in, whatever that thing is, and then take it out after you get your occupancy and you're in the building. Well, I think we kind of touched on that, but do you really want to do that?
Yeah. You know, Jim, for me, it's when I hear that kind of stuff, it's rather cheap entertainment for a little laughter. Because I think to assume that the building official are just some flunky that does, you know, that just gonna sit behind a desk and push paper is, you know, it's a bad assumption. Most of the people that are associated with building codes or code official come from the architectural engineering or construction field. Trust me when I say this. Some of them might even try to pull some of this, the same stunt themselves before they become code official. Okay, they've been around for a while. They know the game. They definitely know the game. If you look at a drawing and it's labeled as a, let's say an office, but there's plumbing in the corner of the office for a shower, you know, a bathroom fixture and so on, they might scratch their head and say, what's that about? Could you explain that? They know the game. Okay? The building official look over everything, approve the drawings or reject the drawings or whatever the issue is. But once you get your permit to build, you have a legal contract with the city. Once it's done and they give you the certificate of occupancy, like Jim say, their partner is called the fire marshal. There's a lot of people at the city that sign off on your drawing, on the design of what you're going to build. That's including the fire marshal, the zoning people, and so on. So they are somewhat familiar with what's there, what should be there, was supposed to be there. So when the fire marshal walk in, he doesn't look just for the fire related violation and stuff. They also are familiar enough with the building to see that you had built new walls or installed new doors or take out code related or require stuff and so on. Right? They're not dummies. okay? But when they do, it'd be very embarrassing to be tagged, and you have to rectify it and all that stuff. I wouldn't play that kind of game. Jim?
No. And it's very costly. It's embarrassing in the sense that, oh, you got caught. But that's not the big problem. The big problem is it costs you money. And like I said, it's going to cost you more money to do it after the fact than it would be just to do it right in the first place from that regard. Now, from a common sense standpoint, we've kind of touched a little bit about that. So in the remaining 15 minutes, I want to talk about, Han and I, we want to talk about common sense kind of issues and common sense kind of usages of things. And this is from experience and things that we've seen and things that we've talked about. Obviously, if you're putting this, like, you know, you're putting a storage area in, common sense is plan for it to be storage so that it is properly protected. If you're putting in or allowing for corridors or doors and that kind of stuff, plan for the ADA. That's common sense. You must do that. And you have to utilize a design professional who understands those things, how to be able to access the building. And it's not just from the inside, it's from the outside as well. Now, another thing that I kind of found that interesting, and we've actually had that happen on one of our projects, is adjacent uses of properties and how they may affect your property. Now, this is a weird situation, but it's something I like to put it into the category: you don't know what you don't know, but you better know at least to ask the question. And the question I would ask, and it's you ask of your design team, is one of easements on your property. Now, what the heck is that? Well, easements on a property can be one of the most design-killing, disastrous, expensive little things that you can think of, because it's a legal document that the property is given to another entity to use for whatever reason. It could be an underground utility. It could be an overhead wire. It could be anything. Okay. And those legal easements basically allow whoever that easement is given to, whether it's a utility company or even a next door neighbor, to drive on your property for what's called an access easement. That allows them to use your property, and you can't do anything with it other than allow them to use that piece of property. So we've had projects where there were easements and went right through the middle of where we wanted to put the building. Well, those had to be moved, or they had to be abandoned, or they had to be investigated to figure out where they're at. Have your design team review all the easements. Do the homework and have them do the paperwork necessary to find those easements and make sure that they're all identified so that they don't come back and bite you later on down the road. Han, you were going to say something?
No, you're right, Jim. The easement is one of those invisible monsters, okay? If you get it all figured out and identify all the easements up front, you can address, it just makes your life a lot simpler. Okay.
Yeah,
again, it's doing your homework.
You can't do anything on that easement other than what they've required. So if there's an easement that cuts through the middle of your property, you can't build on it. You can't do anything on it. You have to leave it alone so that whoever has that easement can utilize it for whatever they're using it for. So again, have your design team, specifically this would be the civil engineer and the survey crew, along with the title company and potentially the survey crew and the title company, along with a easement attorney to identify all those things if there are easements on your property. Because it's mandatory. If you don't, you're asking for trouble down the road. And the next thing you know, you can't build your building because it's over top of an easement, or worse yet, you cut into some underground buried cable, someone gets hurt or injured or killed. It's just bad. It's bad all around. So put that under the category of questions to ask. What about easements on my property? Hon?
It is something that you need to know to find out before you purchase the property, right?
Preferably you would want to know that before you buy the property.
Here's another common sense item.
And Han, I want to add one thing to that, Han. When I say buy the property, this could be buy the existing building just as much as vacant land. It could be either. You could have an existing building that has easements on it that restrict what you can do, or even restrict your ability to add on, or restrict your ability to make a renovation because of that particular easement. So go ahead.
All right. It falls under common sense, in design. There's an exercise that we do. It's called master planning. In master planning, it plans your future growth, okay? So let's say you buy a piece of land, you're going to build your building, and you're going to be there. You know, this is your forever practice, and you plan to expand your services and things like that. Part of the exercise should be also that in the design, you identify where the future expansion need to be, how things going to be punching, how you're going to connect, how the traffic and all that is going to migrate to your building. Okay? Those are things that you need to identify. Draw it out. Actually have it drawn out. Don't just simply say, I'm going to add 2,000 square feet to the right side of my building in the future. Or 3,000 square feet on the left side of the building. Draw it out. Because there is, when you interconnect and merge the additions to the existing building, you need to know where to avoid putting utilities, where to avoid putting supports. It's planning to plan for your future growth. Common sense. Don't let it be chance. So where you say, I'm going to add on, and we're just going to blow out the wall. Okay? It would be very expensive if you don't plan it out. Jim?
Yeah. Han and I have talked about this at length, and especially with Bill and all the things that we talk about on the last 48 radio shows are practical information, extremely important stuff, but things that we've experienced, things that we've seen, things that we have done, and this wealth of knowledge that we're throwing out here on the airwaves, one could say, why are you guys doing this? Because aren't you kind of giving away all the info that you have that people typically would pay for to, have you integrate into the design? And in reality, we are giving away a lot. And we're actually happy to do that because, as we've said before, we want the best for you. And obviously, if you decide to hire us, we want the best for you no matter what. But it's important because there's so many things that we haven't talked about that need to also be addressed. There are just tons of issues and tons of items in the code that will be addressed and need to be addressed when we do a project and go through all that stuff that again, you know, we haven't touched on. So I guess what we're saying is we've touched on just some of the highlights of really what's out there. And I know some of it was kind of a technical in nature, but, and again, that's just the beginning of what it is. A lot of it is much more in depth. And we really do want you to succeed. We extremely want you to succeed because, you know, that's crucial to us. That's why we exist. And I just wanted to throw that out there. On.
Here's a couple items that I you know, it's if you have your building design, or when you have your building design, yes, you meet the minimum requirement for codes and so on. You have a budget. When you deal with space, there's things that are not tangible in the design process, and it's the aesthetic, it's the image. When you go into, you know, when you walk into the lobby for the first time, or the waiting reception area of the practice for the first time, hopefully the new patient receive a good sense that you have a nice, clean, uncluttered office, that your staff is friendly and all that good stuff. So you equip your front of the house, the waiting area, with amenities like TV and maybe aromatherapy, aquarium, fresh hot cookies, a beverage bar and all that stuff. Whatever you decide. So to put in is to let their patient know that you want them to know that they're being pampered, that you care and you care how they think. One of the areas that I've seen a lot, people will judge your practice, the quality of your practice, before they go into the clinical area to get treatment done on them, is your bathroom. This has nothing to do with code, but yeah, it has to do with code. Of course, you have to design it to code. But a bathroom is a place where here's your chance to really let the patient know that their comfort, their need, you're aware of it and you're going to need it. If you're in a pediatric office, you may have a lot of young family where they come with strollers. Well, what do you do with the strollers? Do they take it into the waiting area and suddenly you look like at a daycare center? Where do you park it? Where do they park it? So those things, a docking area, a parking area for the stroller should be taken into consideration. So back to the bathroom is that, all you need is a toilet room or a toilet fixture and a sink, okay? But you can go a little bit more. Common sense is make it so it's comfortable. Make it so that it's not a closet. Make it so it doesn't look like, the gas station down the street. Give them a little room. Give them a little bit of elbow room. Put in the amenities that make their visit to the throne a little bit more pleasant. Okay, upscale. Fixture, upscale lighting, upscale finishes, make the space a little larger, and things like that. I encourage you to invest a little bit more than simply here's a toilet and here's a sink. Okay, it's a marketing thing for you too. It will pay you dividends. And besides that, I sign on a schedule to make sure it is kept tidy, okay, because it's important. Jim?
Yeah, I got to share this little dinky story with you. In traveling down south to see my dad just before the Florida line in Georgia, there's a line of roadside stands basically that sell nuts, pecans and peaches and that kind of stuff. It's all big down there, of course, and they don't advertise the nuts or the pecans or the peaches. Their sign says large, clean restrooms.
That's right.
And you've probably seen it, Hon, because you've driven 75.
I have.
And you know what? That place is packed. It is always packed. And there's two or three other similar kind of facilities like that that are just a maybe another exit, and they don't have the kind of traffic. And it, you know, I laugh every time I see that sign, large clean restrooms. Now, of course, you don't want to do that on the side of your dental office, but the moral of the story is the impression is there that you went to the trouble of making even the restroom as part of the first impression something that is nice. And I guess that's the point, Hon, you were getting at.
Yes, actually, it matters, okay? Restroom matters, right? That's it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully tonight's show, we threw out a lot of stuff that now you have at least in your arsenal to be able to ask questions of your design team if you decide not to use us. If you use us, you're going to hear a lot more. And a lot more questions about a lot of other things, but you know, we'd be glad to help you out in that regard. And again, you know, Hon and I just want to get this information out so that effectively we kind of elevate the whole design process across the board. Because when you are brought to a higher level of knowledge, it makes it easier for you to be able to pick the right kind of people and to pick the right kind of team to be able to move forward and succeed. And that's what we're looking for. So as always, go to our website, ask questions. We'd love to have them. We gather them up, and we're going to have another questions and answers show coming up. I think we got to do something special for our number 50, Hon. I'm not quite sure what it is. Let's think about it. But I think we ought to do a really special show for number 50. And so we got one more show before that, before we jump into that. So we'll think about what we're going to do and hopefully get that out to everybody beforehand. But again, thanks for being part of it tonight. And, you know, we're here to answer any question you want to throw at us. Hon, I'll give you the last words.
Well, I think in a nutshell, you know, what you don't know, so that you can't get what you really need to know. Information, we share this openly, and we give it to you straight. The more you know, the more informed you will be, so you make the better decision for your practice and your future. With that, I certainly appreciate you spending your hours with us. Until next time, have a great evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Hon. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.